Live from New York City. It's Sunday night. This is the Texas. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. And you'll also hear a cast of other characters. John KC2WGB, Paul WS2N, and occasionally we hear from Al K6DPZ. That group of guys gather the clan of Ham Radio to discuss their favorite subject. By the way, if you hear things that you think shouldn't be there, please do us a favor. Go to the reverse mode on your transceiver, listen to 146.25, and tell us what you hear. How strong was it? What direction it's coming from if you've got a directional antenna? What time you heard that signal at that strength? And report it to RFI@LIMARC.org. RFI standing for Radio Frequency Interference at LIMARC.org. We appreciate those reports. TechNet. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. Let me drop. From time to time, I hear somebody say a ridiculous statement. I don't want any useless new information. What's the definition of useless new information? How can information, if it's accurate, be useless? You'll always find some place to use it. Education is always useful. Your parents have told you that from an early age. Make sure you get a good education. It almost doesn't matter what subject. Do as much learning as you can. So this group of guys that gather in the New York City area, among other places, because of our connection with IRLP and Internet, they do their best to educate each other. Not all the information you're going to hear is 100% accurate the first time you hear it. Nobody bats a thousand. But by way of the website where all of this is recorded, you can go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you'll see the last 6.5 years of TechNet recorded. So as those recordings go down and people review them, we hear, by way of that peer review, we hear real fast about the errors, and we come back and correct them the next week or so. Ham radio is a fascinating hobby. It's got about 26 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, 2 meter FM, is just one of those, 2 meter repeater FM. And if for some reason you're displeased with this one, before you give up this extremely educational hobby, try one of the other 25. Okay, a person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment by giving that crew your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. After 31 years of the technical net, this is TechNet number 1488, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be convinced to us anymore. Alrighty, give me a call with his name right now if you've got a question or a comment. K2RIW.
November?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And who we yell, Rich, with a question.
Not to worry, Rich. We got you. I'm hearing you in. I'm hearing you on the input. Anyone else deciding, give me your call letters and name right now.
Yes, good evening, Dick. This is November 2, Yankee Lima. The name here is Mike. Yes, I got a question.
Very fine, Mike. Sounds like you might be coming in by either Echo Link or IRLP. And I'd like to hear more about that. Alrighty, we've got Rich and Mike. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet, give me a call letters and name right now.
KC2QYW, name is Joe, and yes.
We got you, Joe. All right, so far, Rich, Mike, and Joe. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick, and yes, name John.
Some stranger named John just checked in. Okay, we'll pick him up with his question. Anyone else, give me a call with his name right now.
K6DBZ is here for fast answers, Dick.
I knew you would be, Hal.
Paul, with a space report.
Very fine, Paul. And one last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment, give me a call with us right now. And later on, we also want to have a, if there's a little bit of time left over, we want to have anyone who attended the Ham Radio University today give us their impressions, what they liked, what should be improved, and so on. Okay, Rich was the first one with a question. N2EO.
first off, I want to thank people that have come over here to help me. I'm probably forgetting a few people, like Greg, N2 Alpha Sierra Sierra. When I ran out of oil, he came over here, put 15 gallons of oil in my tank. Andy was here the other day, WA2CDL, got my cable TV working for me. Al was here and paid me a nice visit. A lot of people helping me. Anyway, Dick, let me ask you a question. I was on the Weimark Astronomy Net this week, this past week. Is it okay to bring an astronomy question over to this net?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Rich. There was a man living in Whitestone who once told me that there's a darn many subjects we discuss on the TechNet that are not ham radio, that he was displeased by that. I'm having some fun with you, Rich, of course. From my point of view, ham radio operators are curious people about lots and lots of subjects, and therefore anything of reasonable interest can be discussed. As you know, astronomy is one of my favorite subjects, so fire away. N2EO, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, very good. You know, when I was a kid, maybe a 10, 12-year-old child, I had a small telescope. Remember, it was a company called the AC Gilbert Company. And I used it a few years and then got a bottle of radio. And I think this spring, when I feel, you know, when I can walk, I mean, there's nothing wrong with me. Just my muscles have atrophied. And I'm working with physical therapy. Walk. You know, it's very dark here in the street in Massapequa Park in Queens, where tons of streetlights. Now, on the net, the astronomy net, he mentioned, I know there's a whole bunch of brands. He mentioned a brand called Orion for telescope. And I'm not sure why he suggested that one. And, he mentioned a school. I don't want to buy it over the internet. So I don't know what I'm buying. You know, a first-time buyer on this stuff. He mentioned a place, I wonder if you've heard it, called Burger Brothers in Amityville. Which, Amityville is not very far from Massapequa Park. So that's basically what I wanted to find out. Also, he mentioned filters to improve, not only to get rid of light, that's not my problem, but filters to improve contrast. I meant to ask, does they come as a kit of filters? And the last thing I want to know, do these scopes like the Orion come with a mount, or is that separate? Would I be better off buying a polar mount? And, you know, I'm probably going to be using a walker for the foreseeable future. If I had it, a case that I could suspend the handle from a walker, that would be much easier because you don't want to drop this thing. Back to that, and to we are.
Now, Orion is both a brand name and a catalog from my point of view. If you Google the word Orion and you get yourself on their mailing list, they will eventually be sending you a catalog every month or two. And the catalog has got about 30 pages. So the Orion company sells zillions of different kinds of binoculars and telescopes, among other things. So once you've got this Orion catalog in your hand, used most of the catalogs in the earlier pages do a pretty good job of explaining what's the difference between a Newtonian, a Cassegrainian, when it comes to a folded and non-folded type telescopes, more compact or the not so compact ones, the different kinds of mounts, the Dobsonian mount, the polar mount, Azel mounts, and so on. They do a pretty good job of explaining that. So is a catalog of medium good quality. Not super expensive, but medium good quality, and lots of them. There must be 50 different scopes and whatever you can find in there. So, very educational catalog. I recommend you get your hands on one of those. In fact, there's a slim chance I've got a spare catalog that I can mail to you once I know your mailing address, just to make sure you get it in time. Let me drop. Now, arguably on Long Island, there were two real good telescope selling places. I think one of them is Astrotech, I think is the name of it, and the other one is Berger Brothers in Amityville. Berger Brothers got a nice size store, which in the front of the store on the right hand side, they usually have quite a few telescopes and sets of binoculars. You can touch them, feel them, look out the window with them, and so on. It's mostly a camera store that also sells a lot of astronomical equipment. When it comes to the fact that Massapequa is a hell of a lot darker than Whitestone, where you live, to allow you to see a lot more stars. And the only place locally you can go to that's a little bit darker yet is out in the parking lot at Jones Beach. And some of the astronomical clubs will meet there. When you're up and walking, you want to consider going to the ASLI group, Astronomical Society of Long Island. Every single Wednesday, per se, they have a meeting at, now it's the Vanderbilt Planetarium is where they hold their meetings. And a very enthusiastic group of about, I think they have over 100 members, and 25 or 30 of them will show up at each one of these meetings. Some of these guys are very serious, and John Vogt is the most serious guy there, in my opinion. He has home-brewed a 31-inch diameter mirror on a thoroughly transportable telescope, which he can put in the back of his van, and about 45 minutes or so, set it up wherever he drives the thing. 31-inch diameter. And he had to build that mirror twice, because the first one, a special make by Corning Glassworks, had a crack that developed, and so on. So, good group. I do recommend you get a hold of that Orion catalog. Oh, Gilbert, let me drop. And back in my early days, Gilbert was most famous to me for the so-called Gilbert Erector set. And I guess they also had a series of telescopes, which that I didn't know about. Okay, when it comes to selecting your first telescope, I do recommend you go to Sky and Telescope magazine. They've got a website, and one of the early things you can select on Sky and Telescope's website is how you choose your first telescope and or binoculars. Should you use binoculars at first, or some kind of way of holding the binoculars, and or telescope. But one of the first things you got to make sure you don't fall into the trap of is that when you're buying an inexpensive telescope, quite often the manufacturer thinks that the gain of the telescope is the most important thing. And so they'll tell you that it's got a gain of 600, which is, in many cases is crazy. Anything more than you take the number of inches of the forward aperture of the telescope and you multiply it by 60, that's approximately the maximum gain you can get. A 1-inch diameter telescope, you really can't go beyond 60. And even beyond 30, you're probably getting a pretty fuzzy picture. So don't be impressed by gain. Sometimes the lower gain gives you a much clearer picture and a prettier view of the sky and a lot wider view of the sky. One of the other things that's going to amaze you is that there's a zillion different eyepieces you can buy for your telescope. And some of those eyepieces will have 30 degrees apparent field of view, and some of them approach almost 85 or 90 degrees. The wider view eyepieces are usually much more expensive, but they give you a much more pleasant view. You don't feel like you're looking down a straw, if you know what I mean. Lots and lots of things to select with a telescope. It's not easy. It's a little bit like, let me drop it. It's a little bit like a guy who just got his ham radio license. He opens up the back of QST magazine, and he sees 50 different transmitters he can buy. And he tells us, help me select one of these. There's no easy answer to that. Will I be happier if I marry a blonde, brunette, or a redhead? In all cases, whether it be your telescope, the transmitter you buy, or the wife you marry, there's a lot more variables involved than first meets the eye. About the best you can do is start off by doing as much investigation as you can. Talk to your friends and go by word of mouth recommendations sometimes. That's very valuable. If you got enough friends, you go over to their house and look through their telescope and see if you like it, if you know what I mean. Just like if you got enough friends like Ed Limark, you can borrow a rig from them and decide whether or not you like that particular rig before you lay down your money. And should you buy new or used, a lot of variables there. Dave and I and 2APG just recently bought some used binoculars that we're very happy with for a small fraction of the price of brand new. That's some of the information on the subject, Rich. And 2EO, good luck with that eyepiece with your telescope. KQRIW and the TechNet.
Okay, the
KQRIW
and TechNet Limark M2EO. I could take up a half hour or more, but I'm not going to do that. Just want to ask you, you mentioned the eyepiece. Do these scopes come with an eyepiece? And would you recommend a motor-driven polar mount? Well, I've seen them where they have, like, hand cranks as L. I doubt it comes with that.
Almost all real telescopes of reasonable quality, other than something that's intended as a child's toy, will have the eyepiece that's replaceable. In other words, eventually you're going to have two, three, or four different eyepieces, maybe as small as 6 millimeters and as large as 40 millimeters of focal length of the eyepiece. Once you know the focal length of the main piece of lens out in front of the telescope, and the focal length of your eyepiece, you divide one number into the other, and you know the gain you're going to have. Whether it's going to have a gain of 40 or 400, so to speak, is a function of the selection of the focal length of the eyepiece. And within that focal length of the eyepiece, there's a wide angle and narrow angle eyepieces, depending on how many pieces of glass is in there and how they're assembled. There's a zillion different ways of doing it. And some of these really good eyepieces, you can spend easily $600 for an eyepiece because it's a Nagler brand with super wide angle and super low distortion and so on. So you will eventually own multiple eyepieces. Every telescope, when you buy it, will come with at least one, sometimes two. Eventually, you're going to be buying one or two more. And when it comes to how you steer the telescope when you drop
WS2N.
Paul recognized, when it comes to steering the telescope, what is very popular these days is a so-called go-to telescope. There's a whole series of telescopes you can buy that have a built-in computer where you aim it at one or two objects like the North Star and one other object, and it aligns itself, and after that, you've got a great big long list on its display screen where you can decide that, hey, I want to look at the Orion Nebula, and you plug in yes. And it zips its two motors, and it puts Orion Nebula near the center of the eyepiece for you automatically, go to. And that's a little bit controversial, because there are people of the more traditional school who say you should learn how to find things in the sky yourself, and many of the more modern people will say, I don't want to spend my time doing that, I want to look at these things, I don't want to learn celestial navigation, which in itself is a fascinating chunk of the mathematics, so to speak. But they prefer the go-tos, and you pay some extra money for the go-to. So, should the steering of the telescope be Dobsonian as L? Should it be equatorial mount? There's pros and cons on all of this. There's no easy solution to what's the best transmitter to buy, what's the best wife to marry, or what's the best telescope to buy. Ultimately, for a guy of your resources, if you're really interested in astronomy, you will probably end up having multiple telescopes and multiple sets of binoculars at one time in the future, if you're really into it. Because no matter which one you buy, it satisfies 80% of your needs, and the other 20% you're still curious. And Paul, how many telescopes do you own? And I bet you got some nice dark skies out there in Ronkonkoma. WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, and yeah, it's just two, but I just got one. So, it's only a couple of weeks old, so I've only got like 3 days of looking at anything. But I don't know, I think Rich is, my guess is like me, he just wants to play around and look for planets and see what the moon looks like. And if that's the case, when I got this Celestron 70 millimeter diameter, that's a little less than 3 inches. Just to refer refractor. It's just a refractor, and it comes with, you know, you have to look straight. It's got the angle on it, so you look straight down. That 45-degree mirror on it. And like they said, a bunch of eyepieces. This thing came with three eyepieces. It came with a Apollo, if you want to use that. That's a long extension piece. It's 700 millimeter focal length. But it works good. I mean, yeah. I mean, for years I always wanted my own scope where I could see the moons of Jupiter. Well, first time I put it out there, put the first eyepiece in, you know, the wide field eyepiece, there it was, four moons all lined up. And just to confirm that, I went back the next night, and I know that, for instance, Io goes around every 42 hours. It's going to be almost on a completely 180 degrees from where it was, and sure enough, it was there along with the other three planets. I'm talking about the other three moons. I'm talking about the Galileo moons. You know, Io, Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede. Ganymede and Callisto. You're going to go in order from the distance of Jupiter. You can see it quite clearly. So I don't know. Maybe that's all he's looking for. Let me drop it 1 second. You know, all the go-to things and all, you know, they're all good. But if you just want to get an idea if you like what you're doing, I think that Celestron is good to go. But that, it comes with a program, a real interesting program. It replaced my old SkyGlobe program. You put it into the computer, it tells you where all the planets are, what you're looking at, all the different constellations. You point something to it, it'll tell you how many degrees above the horizon it is from your location. Azimuth, elevation of whatever you're looking at whatever time, change the date, change the year, whatever you want to do, you'll know where everything is. So you look it up and say, okay, Jupiter's going to be over there, roughly over there, and you go out and there it is, and that's what I did on day one. A little bit more money is the Celestron. They have a reflector too, inexpensive but high quality, I think. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds like you're having a lot of fun with that 70 millimeter refractor, 700 millimeter focal length. That means you've got an F over D, focal length to diameter ratio of 10. That's a very popular number for the basic telescope, a F number of 10, focal length to diameter. And when it comes to telescopes and binoculars you can buy, I'm going to talk about telescopes in particular. Orion is probably the least expensive, still medium good quality. A little bit higher quality, but still you get a lot for your money, are the other two major brands in my mind, Celestron and Meade. Celestron nowadays has a large selection of things telescope-like. You go to their website, you'll see a lot of things you can select that are getting cheaper and cheaper. A Schmidt-Cassegrain 8-inch diameter telescope, I think at one time was the numbers like $1,500. I think they're coming down to like $900 now. An 8-inch diameter telescope is a lot of stuff, if you know what I mean. One of the other things that I think, there are two things that people quite often forget about with a telescope. Let me drop it. And that is put the right kind of a filter up front. And, I can't think of the name of this German company that makes a kind of what looks like a metallized film, metallized mylar is what it looks like. And you put that in front of the telescope. It's got a density 5, in other words, it cuts everything down by 100,000 to 1. You put that in front of the telescope and aim it at the sun. So sun-time, daytime viewing of the sun, and looking at all those sunspots live, that's an exciting thing to do. Another thing I use my telescope for is not only at nighttime, I like using it in the daytime. I like looking at the birds and the trees and the top of my tower. You'd be amazed how many times I set up a telescope in the driveway, look up at the top of the tower, look at each one of the bolts and cables and whatever and decide, all right, I'm going to need a 7/16 wrench, I'm going to need a set of pliers in order to do that service before I climb the tower the next time. I'm looking at it with my telescope. It was on one of those occasions where I'm using the telescope on the top of the tower, and behind the tower I saw something very, very difficult to explain. And so I had my whole family out in the yard at high noon in August, 3 o'clock in the afternoon in August, looking at these two objects in the sky that hung there for 20 solid minutes. Very difficult to explain. And so, so terrestrial viewing of a telescope in the daytime looking at things. And I'm not talking about looking in people's windows. I'm really talking about looking at, for instance, there's a red-tailed hawk that used to sit on top of my tower. That was his perch. And every time I came out at nighttime, he would squawk at me, letting me know that this is his territory and get the blank out of here because he owns this chunk of land. That was his message to me. And he was a fun thing to look at with a good-sized telescope. So back to you, Rich, for a final. And from my point of view, telescopes, and when you start adding a camera to the telescope, a modern-day charged repeater.
Time out.
Agfa.
Find out, Vic. You said a camera. I'll talk to you more about that at a later date, because that is something I want to do.
Yeah, adding a camera to a telescope gives you a hell of a lot more capability, because a modern-day camera is at least 10 times and maybe 100 times more sensitive than your eye, and you'll see a lot of dim subjects a hell of a lot better. There was an extremely noisy signal where someone else, I think, wanted to make a comment. Who was that? K2LIW and the Tech Man. My name is Dick. Just to make a point there, the AGFA, that the company talking about for the optics? AGFA, Alpha, Alpha George, Fox, Alpha? Oh, don't think I was mentioning AGFA. But brand names are Orion, Celestron, and Mead are some of the most popular brands. Where you get a lot for your money. Okay, we're going to move on to the next person, which was Mike, I think it was. November 2, Yankee, Yankee, Lima. Go right ahead, Mike. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Before we move on, can I give you my new address? If you had a catalog and you don't mind getting rid of it, get rid of
it. Yeah, tell me your address there, Rich.
Okay, Dick, it's 145 Reese Avenue, R-E-I-S-S-E, Reese Avenue, Massapequa Park. And you know, I don't remember the zip codes.
Hey, we got that, Rich. 145 Reese Avenue, Massapequa Park. And if I get a chance, I'll mail you an Orion catalog. And once you get on their mailing list, you'll see, you'll get a catalog from them every month or two. And they've always got some things on sale and bargains or whatever. So when it comes to the least expensive, they're probably the best company. A little bit better is those other two brands I mentioned. Okay, Mike is next. November 2, Yankee, Yankee, Lima. K2LAW. Go ahead, Mike.
Comment?
Person with comment, who is that?
KD2CX, KDX, Here's the company you're looking for is Astronomic, correct?
That sounds right. And I think they used to be in Amityville, is that true?
A theory may be there, maybe Berger Brothers you're thinking of. A better company is Thousand Oaks Optical in California. They make better solar filters, cheaper.
Okay. And Astronomic, where are they located?
The Fatherland.
Okay, there is another telescope company on Long Island that I can't think of the name of right now. We'll come to that later. Mike, November 2, Yankee, Yankee, Lima. You better grab it, Barry, before everybody else does. K2LAW, you got it, Mike.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. The name here is Mike, and got a question about more of transmission lines and scanner antennas. I've seen on like eBay where they have these scanner antennas that actually use, they don't use 50 ohm coax, they use the 75 ohm coax that cable television uses. My question is how reliable is that? Will it degrade the signal as it comes down the coax into a 50 ohm scanner? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that one, Mike. This is one of those areas where, in my opinion, there's a lot of misunderstanding. There are people who will buy a 70-ohm antenna and connect a 50-ohm cable to it, or buy a 50-ohm antenna and connect a 70-ohm cable to it, and then connect that to a 50-ohm rig. And they assume that it's going to explode and all kinds of bad things will happen. In reality, the difference between 50 ohms and 70 ohms is really a minor second-order effect. That's a 1.4 standing wave ratio. In theory, that gives you 0.2 of a decibel of extra loss. And can you resolve that? That's not even the width of the needle on your signal strength meter, your S meter on the rig that has an old-fashioned meter type S meter, if you know what I mean. So don't worry about it. Back in the days when hardline cable from the cable TV company, 70-ohm cable, let me drop it. Because it's lower in loss, almost all cable TV companies use 70-ohm hardline, not 50-ohm. They buy it in 2,000-foot reels. When there's 150-foot of it left over at the end of the reel, they bring it back to the warehouse or the stockyard, and it sits there. You make a, you become friendly with the guy who runs the stockyard, and free of charge, you can get all kinds of 70-ohm hardline cable on those reels that are just sitting there in the stockyard. They don't know what to do with it, so to speak. And you take apart the cardboard, the wooden reel, you take apart the four rods that hold it together, and now you've got a nice roll of hardline cable in your hand. You don't even have to unreel it, if you know what I mean. And take those slats of wood and just put it in their dumpster. I've done that on a couple of occasions. So there's 70-ohm cable you can buy. Lower in loss than anything else that you can buy without spending a whole lot of money from the Andrew Hardline Company, so to speak. And one of the solutions to using 70-ohm cable is to take a piece of paper tape, tape it to the side of the 70-ohm cable, and write the word 50 ohms on it, and make sure the 50 ohms label always faces toward the antenna or toward the rig, so the rig doesn't know the difference. Of course, that's a joke, but you can completely ignore that. If you're a moonbounce operator and you want to pick up that last 0.2 of a dB of insertion loss, to manufacture a quarter wave impedance matching device, which will be a few inches long, to go between the 70-ohm cable and your 50-ohm antenna. It's a very easy thing to build if you have to have that last 0.2 of a dB. But in many cases, 70-ohm cable, because it's lower in loss, even though you're getting 0.2 of a dB of extra loss because of the so-called impedance mismatch, in many cases, the 70-ohm cable, lower in loss than you would have had with anything you could afford any other way, you still come out way ahead. So don't worry about it. About the only other problem people have is that putting connectors on the end of a 70-ohm hardline piece of cable, there's a little bit of a trick to doing that, getting the right connector and installing it.
Repeater, timeout.
So putting connectors on the end of the cable is a little bit of a difficulty to adapt them to conventional connectors. So not to worry, Mike. N2 Yankee Yankee Lima in Cortland Manor, New York. You're out in the boondocks. KQRIW. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, Dick, there you go. It's good to know that I could use the semi-ohm coax for my scanner, and I'll just lose a little bit of signal. That's good to know. Yeah, I'm up here in Cortland Manor. I could hear the repeater on my rig, but you got to be in a right location. I get like a lot of notes up here, so that's why I'm on actually my iPhone right now, coming over Echo Link.
Very fine, Mike. That iPhone and Echo Link is working out very well. Your voice is a tiny bit bassy, but close enough, not to worry. And the repeater itself, the antenna got moved 6 months or so ago for a bunch of reasons of where it had to be moved by the landlord, so to speak, and it got moved to a slightly less desirable location. So the repeater is not quite as loud as it was, say, 6 months or a year ago. And quite possibly that's going to be corrected in the near future. And I talk about this repeater being in New York City. Well, New York City has got 5 boroughs, and this thing is right at the edge of one of those boroughs. Within 500 feet of the edge of the marker, it is in New York City. If they had moved the building 500 feet to the east, they would have been out of New York City. Minor little detail. I'm having some fun. Alrighty. John, I think, is the next guy. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, John. K2 Rally W in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. KC2WGB. Paul, everyone on the net. Dick, I have a question you might be able to help me out with. Let me let her drop, and I'll start.
Yeah, stand by a minute, John. There was another guy named John. Or is it Joe? There is a KC2QYW who signed in just before you. KC2 Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Are you there, sir? I maybe wrote down your name wrong. I think it's Joe, K2LAW.
Hey, Roger. Nick,
tower and I'm passing by a set of guy wires, I
reconnect the upper harness above the guy wires before I disconnect the lower harness below the guy wires. I'm always connected to the tower as I'm doing the climbing. I think it's part of the reason why after 45 years I've had no tower injuries. I've done all kinds of ridiculous injuries to myself while standing on the ground, mowing the lawn or dumping the garbage. Recently I hit my shin real bad into a chunk of steel of a wheelbarrow that was laying sideways in the dark while I was dumping the garbage one night. So in the places where you think the risk is very low is where I've had the greatest injuries. I've never had an injury on the tower because you have to respect the fact that a tower can give you a great deal of injury if you don't respect certain things. And you have to understand the guy wires. There's an incident that occurred about 15 or 20 years ago in Smithtown. Let me drop. Where a group of guys were disassembling I think it was a 60-foot tower. And there's a group of guys on the ground disconnecting guy wires, and a group of guys on the tower lowering tower sections. The group of guys on the ground disconnecting the guy wires got ahead of the guys that were lowering sections from the top of the tower. And so at the critical moment, there was like 45 or 50 feet of tower in the air with two guys on it, and there was nothing except a simple base, which was not strong enough to hold the tower vertical without the guy wires. They disconnected the last guy wire. The tower fell over flat to the ground. The two guys on the tower were heavily injured. So you have to really understand the physics of what keeps a tower standing straight up. My favorite kind of tower is one with guy wires. There are other people who just love self-standing towers that crank up. Well, as a serious VHFer with hard lines, that's a bit of an incompatibility. I'd much rather have a self-standing tower where I can connect the hardline cables to the side of the tower in a more permanent manner. That's just me. That's some of the information which I think you're looking for, Joe. KC2QIW, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Last week I was in the mobile. I was in the... you know, remember, I could...
Joe, you should know that from your current location on both of your transmissions, we're only hearing you 40% of the time. The other 60% of the time, you are dropping out. And whether it's because of extraneous interference or of the way the voting system works, I'm not quite sure what's happening. I figured out what you wanted to say because I was getting every third word, and you mentioned towers and tower safety. And so you're allowed to ask the question again next week. If you know what I mean. You're allowed to ask any question you want as often as you want. Good luck with that project, Joe, but you're doing the right thing. Buy the book, study the safety procedures, talk to people who have done tower work and survived it without injury. Those are, in theory, the right people to talk to, the people who know how to stay uninjured. And dropping a tool from a tower, for instance, and having people standing directly below you on the ground during a tower erecting operation is something you really got to worry about. Some of the things that take place, when people describe it to me, I get nightmares about the injuries that could occur, particularly during field day operations. A few of the field day operations will be erecting a tower in ways that scare me. There's a lot of ways of doing it wrong. And, okay, good luck with that, and certainly research it as much as you can before going forward, Joe. And even after you put up the tower, keep reading information about safety. It's every piece of information. There's no such thing as useless new information. I don't know why in the world somebody said that recently, this week. I don't want any more useless information. There is no such thing as useless new information, useless new learning. Paul? Here we go. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, KC2WGB. All right, I need a little help with the construction issue here. I have a 50-ohm generator going through a 50-ohm cable to a device under test. Now, I want to make up an adapter that I can put in series with this cable, which will allow me to establish contact to four or five instruments, all 50-ohm input, with the least amount. amount of disturbance to that cable. Now, simple T-connectors are not going to work. I was thinking of directional couplers. The items are going to be a frequency meter, a power meter, a scope, spectrum analyzer, all 50 ohm. So maybe you could help me out with that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've run into this problem a number of times, John. It's a good one. My favorite approach is with directional couplers. T-connectors, in a pinch, I've done it. You and I know that when you have two cables coming out of a T-connector with one cable going in, those two cables coming out are really in parallel. Therefore, 50 ohms each, the common port cable is seeing a 25 ohm load. That 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in some circumstances, can give you a lot of grief. In some circumstances, it doesn't matter at all. And if you're smart enough to know the way the radio is flowing, the signal is flowing, and what you're going to, and what kind of test you're running, there are times when you can get away with 2 and 3 T-connectors cascaded together, and there are other times where 1 T-connector can give you a lot of grief. My favorite approach is with directional couplers if you're going to do it in a pure manner. And the directional couplers do not necessarily have to be at the frequency region of the rating. If they're rated for higher frequencies than you're using, that is usually perfectly acceptable. A 10 dB directional coupler rated for, let's say, 200 megacycles, and you're using it at 20 megacycles, I can give you a formula that will tell you the exact number, but the 10 dB of coupling becomes something like 22 dB of coupling, so to speak, when you use it at a much lower frequency. It is still a beautiful directional coupler. It still has 50 ohms in and out on its straight-through port. It still has exactly 50 ohms on its sampling port. So everything is impedance matched, and as long as your frequency counter, for instance, if that's the thing that's off on the coupled port, let me drop it. As long as the signal you're running is strong enough in strength that with 22 dB of attenuation from a directional coupler being misused in the way that I just described, 22 dB less signal going to the frequency counter, if the frequency counter has enough sensitivity and the signal generator is set high enough, then that'll work like a charm. You're counting the frequency, no interference of any kind with all of the setup. And in order to set the signal generator that high, you may have to add an additional attenuator downrange so that the signal is brought down to the level you want to go to into the system of test. So directional couplers are a good way, and off the coupled port of the directional coupler, there you can put a zillion T-connectors without affecting the great straight-through line. The nice thing about the directional coupler is the decoupled port acts like it's not only attenuated, but it's also directionally attenuated, so that if I'm using a 10 dB directional coupler, and I want to connect 5 other pieces of equipment, and I've, out of the 10 dB directional port, 10 dB down, so to speak, I put a whole bunch of T-connectors together. As long as the oscilloscope and spectrum analyzer are not incompatible with each other, and the frequency counter are, you know, incompatible, your frequency counter might have a local oscillator that gets re-radiated. It might show up on the spectrum analyzer screen, and once you know what it is and what you're looking at, it's not a problem. So once you attenuated the signal on the directional coupler port, there you can put a dead short, so to speak, and the straight-through line between the signal generator and the device under test will never know about it. And how much interference that creates is calculatable, but it's not even a second-order effect, it's a tertiary effect. So once you learn the magic of a directional coupler, and I've got an article on that exact subject, let me drop it. An article on that exact that subject, how to properly use directional couplers and improperly use them in ways that are not violating any laws of physics. I had an article on that subject on the so-called technical section of the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG. For reasons I don't understand, that beautiful technical section of Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG.org or .com, .org I think it is, they eliminated that technical section. Why in the world they did that and was so valuable, I don't understand. But by way of the Wayback File, a year or so ago, for the previous 5 years, it was there. By way of a Wayback File, you can find it. So you go to the technical section of K5RMG, Roadrunners Microwave Group, you look at their technical section, you'll see a series of 10 articles at the bottom of the page called the K2RIW Corner. and one of those articles gives you a lot of information about using directional couplers. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, John.
Okay, with a comment.
Go ahead, Eric.
I've run into that situation a number of times, and my solution was rather elegant, actually. I have a piece of inch and a half EIA pipe with the appropriate connectors on both ends, and that's using end connectors. And I have a line of six directional couplers hanging on the pipe. If you use a VNA or a sweep generator, you can actually calibrate each one to the amount of attenuation you're interested in based upon what you're feeding through the pipe. And it's a nice little piece of pipe with six little gizmos, which has the forward and reverse ports on them. And it's a cool way to do it. K2IWK, here, John.
Are you a guy who understands directional couplers and how to do that? The words you just used describe it very well. To the rest of us, not quite as informed. You've got this inch and a half diameter piece of pipe, coaxial cable. And what I think you did is the equivalent of the Monty match. In other words, this kind of a standing wave ratio circuit that was in QST magazine and the American radio, here we go, the ham radio handbook, where you take a piece of enameled wire and sneak it under the braid of a piece of RGA cable. And when you properly terminate the two ends, one end at least with a diode detector and the other end with a properly chosen resistor, you've made a homebrew high performance directivity directional coupler. And I think that's what you're doing. I believe you're putting extra pieces of wire near the shielded outer conductor of this piece of pipe with connectors on each end. It has an extremely minor perturbation to the impedance of the main rod flowing down the center, but each one of those extra wires you added is itself a directional coupler. Is that approximately what you just told us, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
No, well, that's kind of the principle, but I cheated since I have these little dielectric directional coupler receivers. Essentially, you drill a hole in the pipe, and you take a little spotter, and you mount these flanges on it, and it's actually a little round device, and on the bottom of it essentially has the wire and the diodes in it, and two end connectors on the top of it. And you stuff that into the pipe, and it runs parallel to the center conductor. You get the idea.
Okay, that thing you added, is it a little bit like the slug of a bird watt meter? Is that what the device is that you're describing, Eric? Go ahead.
I'm waiting for it to drop. Hang on. In essence, yes. It's sort of like taking bird slugs and putting them out. Now, actually, if you look inside your bird 43 watt meter, it's exactly the same thing. You'll see when you pull a slug out, you see the center conductor, which is a little bit of a pipe, and the slug sits parallel to it in one direction. You flip it around, and you get the other direction. Well, these devices made by Dielectric, or Myatt, whatever company you want to use them. Using the broadcast industry, it has actually two sensors there, one for forward and one for reverse.
Very fine, Eric. If you took the effort of taking apart a bird slug of a bird watt meter, you'll find that the line inside really is a directional coupler line. In other words, it's a small loop of wire, so to speak. One end has got a precision resistor, the other end has got the diode detector. And when the resistor is properly selected, it becomes a very good directional coupler. And the length of the wire and the closeness to the main center conductor of the pipe, so to speak, determines whether or not the slug is a 1 watt, 10 watt, 1,000 watt slug, and so on. What percentage of the power is it sampling? As you can tell, there's some extra noises in the background by our local jammer. I'd like you guys to listen on the input 146.25. Tell us what you hear. How loud? What time did you hear it? If you've got a directional antenna, where is it coming from? And report that to rfi@limarc.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference. So report it to rfi@limarc.org. We'd like to hear as many of those reports as possible, because this individual in the last few days is getting very rambunctious. At a time, I think we try to convince him that he's being very annoying to the rest of the world, and it's not being appreciated. Alrighty. So as you can tell, John, there's lots and lots of ways of doing it, but directional couplers are the most sophisticated ways. And once you've got one single directional coupler in that straight through line from, let me drop. That straight through line from your signal generator to the device of the test, on that directional line, you can get away with murder. You can now put all kinds of T connectors, make all kinds of impedance mismatches and whatever, because whatever signal gets reflected back to the directional coupler port of the directional coupler, that in turn is being redirected on the main line with 20 dB of attenuation in my example, 10 dB out, 10 dB back, and it will be directed not toward the device on the test, but directed back toward the signal generator. And if the signal generator is a good 50 ohm source, it'll absorb all of that reflected power and create no grief to the device on the test and to the measurements being made. So, guaranteed, there's a zillion ways of doing it, but going along this direction is probably one of the best, most sophisticated ways. Whenever automatic test equipment is set up in a factory where you want to run a bunch of equipment simultaneously in the ATE mode, computer orchestrated, this is the method that's quite often used. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, thank you, Dick. Good information. And you anticipated my question about loading the sampling port, so that solved that also. And Eric had an interesting piece there. That sounds like a good little item to construct. But okay, I'll turn it back to you, and thanks for the answers. KC2WGB.
Yeah, one of the amazing things about directional couplers, once you understand their theory of operation, is there's nothing magic about having one single directional coupler, one single directional coefficient on one single frequency on one single unit. In other words, if Eric wanted to, he starts off with this piece of inch in diameter pipe where he's got connectors on both ends. That's the straight through line. He could, if he wanted to, put multiple pieces of wire in there with connectors on each end, a connector on the near end and a connector on the far end, and a straight piece of wire between the two, a piece of enameled wire, so to speak. The closeness of the coupling between that piece of enameled wire and the center conductor, that determines the coupling coefficient. Is it a 6 dB coupler or a 25 dB coupler, so to speak? The closeness of the wire. The length of the wire tells you the frequency where it gives you maximum performance. That's where the length of the wire is a quarter wavelength. That's where you get maximum performance. But you can make it a hell of a lot less than a quarter wavelength long. Eighth wave, tenth wave, 20th of a wave. That is what's going on inside of the bird slug. And let me drop. And once you realize that each one of these wires is sucking up a tiny bit of the signal, if it's a 10 dB coupler, one-tenth of the power is going there, 90% of the power is still going down the straight line. If it's a 20 dB coupler, because you've got a little bit greater spacing, then 99% of the power is going down the straight line, and 1% of it is going into your directional coupler network. There's nothing stopping you from, when you look down the throat of the pipe, putting one of those directional couplers at 12 o'clock, one of them at 3 o'clock, one of them at 6 o'clock, one of them at 9 o'clock, your single straight piece of pipe. Stop, stand by a second. Had a cough. Your single straight piece of pipe can simultaneously be a 10 dB, a 20 dB, three different 20 dB couplers, a 10 dB coupler, all connected together simultaneously on the same piece of pipe. And each one is sucking up 10%, 3%, 1% of the power, if you know what I mean. Therefore, the calculatable amount of attenuation on the straight through line, you might...
2 meter, transmit.
You might end up with 1.5 dB of total loss on the straight through line because of all the couplers you've added there. Calculatable, calibratable, and perfectly acceptable, and all those directional couplers are running simultaneously, each one acting as if it's an independent directional coupler compared to all the other. There's nothing in the world of physics stopping you from doing that. The only reason why that hasn't become a commercial product is people are not smart enough to understand it to request it, and they're